From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The investigation of the bombing last week in Oklahoma City is focusing on the possible involvement of right-wing paramilitary organizations. Coming up on Fresh Air, I'll speak with Chip Berlay about the anti-government sentiment that fuels these groups. Berlay has tracked the rise of the so-called Patriot Movement and other right-wing groups. Also, we remember poet Jane Kenyon, who died over the weekend of leukemia. She lived and wrote in New Hampshire with her husband, poet Donald Hall. And Kevin Whitehead tells us about the life and music of the late jazz pianist Don Polin, who also passed away this weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal law enforcement authorities are discounting any link between a man apprehended over the weekend in Southern California and the bombing last week in Oklahoma City, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
The FBI is still searching for the man identified only as John Doe 2. Daniel Iniguez, who was absent without leave from Fort Riley, Kansas, is not a suspect, Special Agent Weldon Kennedy told reporters Monday.
At this time, we have not found any connection between the individual in custody in California and the Oklahoma City bombing. He has been turned over to military authorities. John Doe, number 2, has not been identified and remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous.
Timothy McVeigh is the only person in jail so far in connection with the bombing. Two brothers are being questioned as material witnesses. The FBI is pursuing thousands of leads in this case, including some that may point to more possible suspects. In Oklahoma City, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The death toll has risen by 1 to 79 in Oklahoma City. That number does not include a nurse who died yesterday from head injuries. She had been one of the first rescue workers on the scene last Wednesday. President Clinton used a speech today in Minneapolis to denounce those who use hate and promote violence. He is seeking broad new powers to fight terrorism. Some civil libertarians are worried, but Chief of Staff Leon Panetta says the proposals won't remove Americans' freedom. Peace negotiations between the Mexican government and Zapatista rebels in the southern state of Chiapas have been suspended until next month. The two sides will meet again May 12th to discuss proposals for ending the Zapatistas' 16-month rebellion. The BBC's Morris Walsh reports.
The official word was that the first round of peace talks between the Mexican government and the Zapatista guerrillas in more than a year had gone well, and that the negotiations would merely pick up again on the 12th of May. But that optimistic gloss was called into question when the Zapatista commanders spoke an hour after the talks had ended. Their leader, Comandante Tacho, said the government delegation was not talking about a peace agreement, but only about the surrender of the guerrillas. This is the way the rebels interpret the government's proposal that they must move their forces into three predetermined zones in Chiapas, where they would effectively be under the control of the Mexican army. Comandante Tacho accused the government side of negotiating as if a settlement had already been agreed. The Zapatistas' demands still had to be negotiated, he said.
Morris Walsh reporting. Reuters News Service reports there has been a large explosion in Sarajevo. It was reportedly followed by another blast. Several people are wounded. Reuters is quoting local reporters who say the blast was very strong, even by Sarajevo standards. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has shot up 35 points to 4,305. This is NPR. Chrysler's board has unanimously reaffirmed the company is not for sale. It sent a letter to investor Kurt Kerkorian saying his buyout offer would leave the number 3 automaker crippled by excessive debt. Chrysler officials also say they'll hold their $7 billion worth of cash reserves. The company says it needs the cushion to weather any downturn in the economy. A U.S. relief agency finished a relief airlift to Vietnam today with 50 tons of medical supplies. It's the biggest effort of its kind since the war ended 20 years ago. The Heart to Heart group organized the mission with help from some U.S. Vietnam veterans. NPR's Mary King Magstead reports from Ho Chi Minh City.
The Federal Express plane that arrived on the tarmac of the Ho Chi Minh City airport this morning was loaded with antibiotics and aspirin, surgical tools, and even birth control pills. Gary Morsch, the chairman of Heart to Heart, says the idea behind the airlift was to reverse the symbolism of American helicopters fleeing Saigon 20 years ago with a sign that Americans are ready to come back and help.
We hope that this airlift will ignite a tremendous wave of similar types of projects from Americans to Vietnam, and I really believe this is just the beginning of a new era of help.
Republican Senator Christopher Bond of Missouri was in Vietnam for the airlift. He says he hopes the U.S. and Vietnam will soon be able to move toward having closer diplomatic relations as well. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Ho Chi Minh City.
A news report from South Korea indicates North Korea may be willing to continue talks with the United States about its disputed nuclear program. The report quotes a North Korean official who says Pyongyang could resume a dialogue, but with certain conditions. The agency says the official refused to spell out what the conditions might be. Washington is proposing a change to higher-level political talks in Geneva next month. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The investigation into the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City has drawn attention to the militia movement, a loosely knit web of right-wing paramilitary organizations that exist around the country. My guest, Chip Berlay, is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates, an institute that studies authoritarian, right-wing, and xenophobic political movements. For more than 20 years, Berlay has been tracking the rise of the extreme right, from the militia movement to white supremacist groups like the neo-Nazi Aryan Nation and the Ku Klux Klan. Although the militias vary, Berlay sees some underlying beliefs they all share.
The militia movement in general is built around a core theory that the government is about to impose some form of repressive martial law or take away our civil liberties, and that the first step in that is gun control. But behind that is a larger suspicion that secret elites control the government in some way. That's a belief structure, by the way, of the entire Patriot movement, which is a movement of as many as 5 million people in this country who listen to everyone from the neo-Nazi right on the far right to people like the Birch Society and Pat Robertson, who promulgate conspiracy theories about the Trilateralists and the Masons on the moderate wing. And everything in between is the Patriot movement, out of which comes the armed militias, which are the armed wing of the Patriot movement. And all of this is taking place in the background of a populist right-wing revolt that really is a backlash against the movements of the 1960s and is also linked to a declining economy in the heartland where a lot of people feel economically distressed.
As far as these militias go, do they have clearly defined objectives that you can pinpoint, or are they preparing in a more global sense for civil war?
Some of them are clearly preparing for civil war. Some of them would argue that they are preparing to be defensive, in defense of the Constitution and in defense of liberty against a tyrannic government. Some of them are aggressively proactive and believe that there will have to be a civil war provoked by them to restore liberties which they feel have already been lost. So there's a range of zealotry, there's a range of paranoia, there's a range of reasons why people join. The single unifying theme is that the big government is out to get you and that you have to arm yourself in defense of liberty. And they see themselves, remember, as the new patriots standing at the bridge in Concord. Unfortunately, they're belief in this conspiracy theory is irrational, and so they're acting on these beliefs as if they were real, but they're not.
I'd like to know exactly what goes on in a meeting of one of these militias.
Well, there's two forms. There's your basic lecture format, and there's your basic outdoor activity. The outdoor activity would consist of getting dressed up in camouflage clothing and training with live weapons, shooting at targets, learning how to get under barbed wire, learning how to establish a defensive perimeter around a building, and all that good stuff, including first aid training and intelligence training and communications training. And that takes place out in the woods someplace or in your community someplace. The basic, informative lecture format might start with a video by Mark of Michigan or Linda Thompson or William Cooper talking about the variety of the conspiracy that they're most interested in that day, something to do with the New World Order being imposed throughout the world by a sinister elite, and that's why the economy is so bad, and that's why things are going to hell in a handbasket. Then it would depend on what kind of militia you were in. In some militias, the most extreme, you would then learn about the Jewish bankers and that how blacks are taking over America. In the more moderate ones, you would learn about how the Trilateralist Commission and runs the world on behalf of the Rockefeller family. And then there would be variations. Some militias, you would learn about how it's God wants you to stop abortions. Some militias would talk to you about how the real terrorists are the environmentalists. You might find that we're in the biblical end times and the mark of the beast is coming as prophesied in Revelations. You might find that the Second Amendment is the cornerstone of the Constitution and therefore gun control is the single biggest issue in your life. The only through line would be the government is bad and about to take away your liberty and that the first step of that process is taking away your gun.
And this would all take place in some big Grange Hall or lecture hall? And
everything. The one I attended here in Massachusetts was in a high school auditorium. They could be in a Grange Hall. They could be in an auditorium that's rented for the occasion. It really depends on the size of the audience. And the audiences in some of these meetings are upwards of 700 to 1,000 people, although they tend to dwindle down as time goes on.
Are there people there hawking their books?
There are book displays. There are displays of dried food pallets that you can have delivered to your door by a truck with 6 months of food and water all palletized and dropped off on your front door. There are long theoretical articles on the secular humanism conspiracy theory and outcomes-based education as a brainwashing attempt against your children. There would be a display of some mechanical devices that don't require batteries because the electricity is going to be cut off, so you need hand-crank flashlights and hand-crank radios and things like that. There's a whole subculture. This is actually a very large subculture in our society that's virtually invisible to the average person.
There's a book circulating now among the more extremist groups that includes a description of a bombing of a federal building. It's called The Turner Diaries.
That's correct.
Is this the book each new recruit gets handed once they show up at a meeting?
No, it's the book that the most neo-Nazi, most zealous terrorist wing of the militia movement would take seriously as their Bible. I would say that the average militia member has more likely read Pat Robertson's book, New World Order, than the Turner Diaries or Hunter. And indeed, Hunter talks about the political assassination of Jews, politicians, and homosexuals, where the Turner Diaries talks about blowing up a federal building. But this would be like the manual for the armed terrorist underground of the militia movement. Most militia people read The New American from the John Birch Society or Pat Robertson's books, which, by the way, talk about the New World Order and the Illuminati and the Freemason conspiracy theories really quite out in the open. Some theories, in fact, cited back to sources that are overtly anti-Semitic. And so this is a much more popular discourse than people know. But that's the mainstream discourse in the militia movement, is this paranoid conspiracy theory about the Freemasons and the New World Order.
If you go to one of these meetings and you're in the big hall looking over everyone's literature, would you...
How would you get recruited into the terrorist underground?
Yeah, well, would you come upon the Turner Diaries or a manual on how to build a bomb right next to a display of homeschooling?
Right. Well, yeah, the way it would work in terms of how you move from the moderate to the militant mode is you'd go to one of these meetings, you'd be standing at this bookstore display, and the bookstore would say, we have everything, we don't censor. So they would have everything from a homeschooling manual to a diatribe against abortion to a book like the Turner Diaries or Hunter, which I picked up at the militia meeting I went to, and they'd all be intermixed. And if you'd be sitting there looking at one of the more neo-Nazi books, for instance, somebody might sidle up to you and say, if you're really serious about that, you should come hear a lecture by so-and-so that we're going to have in my home next week. And if you went to that lecture and you nodded at all the right places, somebody might call you a week later and say that maybe you'd like to come to another meeting. And if you sort of passed all the tests of the right zealotry and the right background check, you might then get invited to be part of a 12-person cell that would divide up into communications and manufacture and delivery and counterintelligence and end up going out with a truck to buy fertilizer.
There was a book that circulated among left-wing groups called The Anarchist Cookbook, taught you how to make bombs. Is that still in print, and is it circulating now among these right-wing groups?
Well, in fact, The Anarchist Cookbook is alive and well and circulating through all of the militia movement, available at your local gun store. So, yes, that's still around. And there is an interesting overlap. There are some people who think of themselves as progressive and left-wing who are increasingly buying into these essentially fascistic theories of state repression, and that they're so offended by the federal government that they're willing to work with ultra-reactionary forces against this repressive regime. Well, I will point out to you that that was the operating theory of National Socialism in Germany.
My guest is Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates. He tracks right-wing groups. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Chip Berlay is my guest. I'd like you to describe for us how significant Waco and the Branch Davidian siege is to these groups and how they use it in their rhetoric.
Well, again, I get away from the extremist lunatic paradigm and say, you know, a social movement forms when there's a demand for it by a discontented population. So you had basically you had a movement waiting to happen, coming out of this backlash against all of the civil liberties and civil rights movements of the 60s and the environmental movement, because early on, many of the people who the militias first started to come up against in the far west were environmental activists. So you had this population ready for a movement to happen. Then you have these two galvanizing incidents, the Weaver family standoff and the Branch Davidian situation, which was both cases of government misconduct, clearly, where there were miscalculations and deaths resulted, many deaths in the case of the Waco incident. That was the galvanizing moment to bring together a number of diverse right-wing groups around the belief that the time had come to stop the repressive government. The issue they then mobilized around, because every social movement needs an issue to mobilize around to build that common unified goal, was to stop gun control because of the Brady Bill and the Crime Control Act. So you had the galvanizing moment, pulled these people together, they organized a social movement to stop gun control, and then they made the first big transition of all social movements is that they got beyond their first issue and survived as an ongoing social movement.
So these groups, or the members of these groups, see themselves at a critical juncture as having more power, more resonance in society, more significance than ever before?
Yes, and at a critical moment when they are going to be the people who stop this descent into tyranny.
No group has specifically taken credit for this act, obviously. What significance do you read in this? And I'm thinking, if one of these groups is behind the Oklahoma bombing, do you see this anonymity as part of a strategy?
Sure. It is likely that the people who blew up this building, if it turns out to be tied to the right-wing terrorist underground, are people who engage in leaderless resistance. Comes out of the race-hate movement, and it basically is this idea of individual selves taking responsibility for their own acts of violence to destabilize the government and bring down the government so that the true constitution can be restored. So it would be a tactic, I think, to not claim credit. It's the politics of destabilization.
Richard Snell was a white supremacist who was convicted of murdering a Jewish businessman and a black police officer. He was executed 12 hours after the explosion last Wednesday. And he said as his last words, "Look over your shoulder, justice is coming." Now, before his execution, many militias had been protesting his death sentence and calling for action in their literature. How does he fit into this story?
He fits in as a martyr, as a symbol of the patriot going to his death standing for liberty. And again, I'm not telling you what I think, I'm telling you what that they think. There's two other through lines. Obviously, one is that it was the second anniversary of Waco. Another one is that it was Patriots Day here in New England, Concord's just down the road from where I live. These people remember, self-perceive themselves as the new Minutemen, the new Patriots. Snell is a martyr to that cause for many of them, the most extreme wing, I have to admit, but the people most likely to take a terrorist act. And Waco was an incident that was seen as proving that the tyranny had arrived, that the government was run by traitors. And there also was the idea that the government had to be made to pay for what happened in Waco. And if you believe, if you're coming from Old Testament biblical law, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, blowing up an office building of federal workers and their children is just retribution for what the government did in Waco.
Well, I'm trying to place the bombing in Oklahoma in a context of escalating violence among these groups. And 6 months ago, civil liberties organizations began warning that the potential for violence among the militias was on the rise. What evidence did they have?
Well, I was one of those people. And the evidence was their increasing rhetoric, the increasing number of people who seemed willing to believe that something apocalyptic was about to happen. There were several times on the internet and in the fax networks when there were these alerts that went out that the invasion was coming and people should flee their homes. So there was an increasing sense of militancy and resorting to violent rhetoric in the radio broadcasts and in the newsletters and newspapers and in public speeches. The militia movement continued to grow after the midterm elections, and you would have thought that if this was a social movement that was more electorally oriented, that the November elections would have undercut it. But it continued to grow because these people were so angry and so frustrated that they didn't even think the Gingrich Congress was right-wing enough to satisfy their demands, even though gun control played a major role in the election of many of these people. So I think it was only a matter of time. I know I'm not the only person who said this. I mean, there were people at the Coalition for Human Dignity, at the American Jewish Committee, at the Center for Democratic Renewal, at the Anti-Defamation League, our group, Political Research Associates. We were all running around, even Planned Parenthood. It was people running around saying, don't you get it? This is going to explode. And I have to tell you, in this community of researchers knew there was going to be some action that was going to take place on that day. We just had no idea it would be so horrific. I mean, some of us thought they might blow up a radio tower from a government radio tower, or they might do a pipe bomb in the back of some IRS office. Nobody imagined it would be something like this. We thought it worse that they would assassinate some government agents.
So what steps did you recommend
months ago and all along? We recommended that people take this seriously, and of course, to the most part, people thought that we were crazy. Hand-wringers. I mean, I got to tell you, I've tried to pitch this story to the media for about a year now, and for the most part, with few exceptions, there was not any real sense that this was a dangerous movement. It was, for the most part, covered as something that was very comical.
I was thinking that the denial that we saw in the first 24 hours of the bombing, the denial that this might be something that involved homegrown terrorism, has been functioning for years and is part of the resistance to warnings from analysts like yourself.
Sure.
Has it also prevented the government from developing good surveillance of these groups?
Well, you got to be cautious here. I mean, I am a card-carrying member of the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild as a paralegal investigator. The problem is this. The vast majority of people in the militia movement are engaged in activities that are entirely legal and protected by the First Amendment, and that you could put agents all throughout the militia movement, and it is unlikely that they would penetrate the terror cells that carry out the criminal activity. And I can tell you this with some certainty, because I was a paralegal who read literally 100,000 pages of FBI and other government files of infiltration of groups like the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement. And in fact, sending infiltrators and doing surveillance of these movements was almost pointless in terms of trying to track militant underground groups like the Weather Underground. That's not how you find these people. That's not how you stop these people. So we have to be very careful not to trade our civil liberties for some meaningless quick fix that erodes our rights around the terrorism bill, a terrible bill. Allowing the FBI to conduct massive surveillance, it's a bad idea, and it isn't effective.
So what does work?
Well, there's two things that work. One is to just accept the fact that terrorism has to be protected against, but also that terrorist groups come out of a social milieu and that you have to address the underlying social problems to stop the terrorism. There's always going to be a handful of people who engage in irrational terrorist acts, but terrorism is carried out by people who have a political commitment to an idea that is current in the society. They are merely the most zealous messengers of that idea.
Do you think the end of the Cold War has fed the anger of these right-wing groups, that not having a foreign communist enemy to unite against has turned them towards their own country?
Well, you've hit on something, but I want you to split it into two issues. The end of the Cold War changed the scapegoat from global communism to the federal government and creeping whatever tyranny. What But social movements are based on a real self-interest anxiety. The globalization of the economy has, in fact, created a situation where people who bought into the social contract, who were many of them are veterans, many of them worked for many years, you know, they feel like the social contract has been ripped up and thrown in their face. They did everything they were supposed to do, and now they're getting screwed. So that anger is what then mobilizes them, and it's then the scapegoat that they choose to pick that is determined by the end of the Cold War. You can't blame it on creeping communism destroying the moral fiber of America anymore. You have to blame it on the federal government, and it's let's invert what's really going on here. The government is to blame because it's allowing all of these people, like blacks, women, immigrants, welfare mothers, to become parasites on the society and to force us to be politically correct, so to speak, which we don't want to do. So really what it is that although there are women and black people and Jews in this movement, they're very, very a small portion of it. This is, in fact, primarily straight white Christian men reacting to their loss of privilege and status in a society that is being globalized economically and cutting off their career paths, and that is changing rapidly in terms of social conventions around sexism and racism and homophobia.
How far back, then, can you trace the origins of the Patriot Movement?
Well, in a sense, all the way back to the Salem witch hunts and the scapegoating of women who were non-traditional, and back to the anti-Masonic conspiracy theory. What you have to look at is that throughout this movement, there are states' rights arguments that were the code words for the segregationist movement. Some of these constitutional arguments go back and were the idea that the state didn't have to obey federal laws that it didn't agree with that led to the Civil War. So that even though that's not why many people join this movement, that really is embedded in the movement. And also some of these conspiracy theories go back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, anti-Semitic forgery, go back to the Jewish banking conspiracy theories. And again, even people who might join the militias thinking seriously that they have nothing to do with racism and anti-Semitism are really being woven into a movement where these are echoes that are very distinct. And so people have to be aware that even if someone says, I would never be a racist or anti-Semite, but I'm in the militia, that embedded in the militia movement are some of these historic racist and anti-Semitic themes.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk on Fresh Air today.
You bet. Thanks.
Chip Berlay is a senior analyst at Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Barbara Bogave with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember poet Jane Kenyon, who died Saturday of leukemia. 2 years ago, we talked with her and her husband, poet Donald Hall, about how they shared their lives and their writing with each other. A collection of Jane Kenyon's most recent poems is expected to be published next spring. And Kevin Whitehead remembers jazz pianist Don Pullen. Pullen had a distinctive percussive approach to playing piano. At times, he'd use the backs of his hands and even his elbows to hit the keys. Pullen died Saturday at the age of 53. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The death toll from the Oklahoma City bombing has reached 79. Searchers found the body of a Marine recruiting officer still at his desk. At least 100 people are still missing. Federal authorities have charged one man in connection with the blast. They have detained two brothers as material witnesses. President Clinton used a speech today in Minneapolis to denounce those who hate and called on Americans to speak out against them.
If they insist on being irresponsible with our common liberties, then we must be all the more responsible with our liberties. When they talk of hatred, we must stand against them. When they talk of violence, we must stand against them. When they say things that are irresponsible, that may have egregious consequences, we must call them on it.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says the President and the Attorney General are handling this terrible situation well.
I commend President Clinton for the way he and his administration have responded to this tragedy. The criminal investigation has been thorough and swift, and the tone set by the President is right on the mark. Killing innocent children and other defenseless citizens is a depraved act of depraved minds. I also want to commend Attorney General Reno for publicly stating that she will seek the death penalty. If ever there was a crime deserving of the ultimate sanction, this is it.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole. Thousands of Rwandans are fleeing a refugee camp in Rwanda that turned violent over the weekend. Some 2,000 people died when government soldiers fired at the camp, claiming it sheltered people guilty of war crimes. The Rwandan government says only 300 people died. The BBC's Roger Hearing reports.
With Kibeho virtually deserted, the focus of attention has now moved to Butare, the nearby provincial capital, where aid agencies say more than 20,000 people who fled from the camp are crowded into the football stadium. Many others from Kibeho and the other camps being closed by the authorities are on the roads leading to the town. The UN World Food Programme says it's providing high-energy biscuits and other food for the exhausted refugees, many of whom have not eaten properly since the first soldiers arrived at Kibeho on Tuesday. The UN is now trying to help return the refugees to their homes they fled last year, but there have been reports that those who've gone back have been attacked by hostile neighbors and some killed by soldiers seeking revenge for last year's massacres during the Civil War.
Roger Hearing reporting. Microsoft and the Justice Department say a federal judge overstepped his authority when he rejected their antitrust settlement. But lawyers who opposed the settlement say the judge didn't go far enough. Attorneys for all sides have made their argument before a federal appeals court today. The settlement forced Microsoft to change the way it sells operating software. On Wall Street, stock prices closed at a new record. The Dow closed at 4,303. This is NPR. The Bosnian Prime Minister is welcoming news that top Serbian officials have been named as possible war criminals. Haris Seljajic says he thinks justice should be done, even if it hurts peace efforts in his country. The United Nations is worried about just that. It fears the announcement by a war crimes tribunal in the Netherlands could hamper aid deliveries and jeopardize UN peacekeepers in Bosnia. The tribunal is investigating Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and two others on a wide range of charges, including genocide. German police have arrested dozens of demonstrators trying to block the transport of nuclear waste. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Anti-nuclear protesters were unable to stop the departure of a train carrying nuclear waste from a reactor in southern Germany to a repository in northern Germany. Police removed more than 60 demonstrators from train tracks to allow the shipment to leave on schedule. The transport is being accompanied by police from the anti-terrorist unit. More than 6,500 policemen are protecting the nuclear waste shipment. Overnight, nuclear opponents damaged electrical wiring along the planned train route, causing millions of dollars in damage and delaying tens of thousands of commuters. Previous government attempts to ship the nuclear waste were blocked by lawsuits from nuclear energy opponents. Further demonstrations are expected tomorrow when the rail transport reaches its final destination at Gorleben in northern Germany. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
An annual study of the quality of airlines says consumers are paying more but getting less from carriers. The fifth annual survey of airline quality rating was done by Wichita State University's Barton School of Business and the University of Nebraska's Aviation Institute. As an example, the survey showed travelers want to save time, like taking a nonstop flight. But the researchers say airlines still want to use their hub system, and that means changing planes. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. We were very sorry to hear today of the death of poet Jane Kenyon. She died Saturday of leukemia at the age of 47. She was at her home in New Hampshire in the company of her husband, fellow poet Donald Hall. Jane Kenyon wrote 4 volumes of poetry. Many of her poems appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The Paris Review, and other publications. Adrian Rich said of Kenyon's poetry, "Tranquil on the surface, Kenyon's New England landscapes often suggest troubled depths, never complacency." Fresh Air critic Lloyd Schwartz was a friend of Kenyon's and an admirer of her work. He says that beneath that darkness was a profound and spiritual optimism. In fact, Kenyon often wrote about the restorative power of nature in the midst of depression, illness, and death. Terry Gross talked with Jane Kenyon and her husband Donald Hall in September 1993. Ironically, much of the interview was about how they dealt as a couple with Donald's illness. It wasn't until several months later that Jane Kenyon was diagnosed with leukemia. We begin with Jane Kenyon reading an excerpt from a poem she'd written about her husband's cancer surgery.
Chrysanthemums. The doctor averted his eyes while the diagnosis fell on us, as though the picture of the girl hiding from her dog had suddenly fallen off the wall. We were speechless all the way home. The light seemed strange. A weekend of fear and purging. Determined to work, he packed his dictaphone, a stack of letters, and a roll of stamps. At last the day of scalpels, blood, and gauze arrived. Eyes closed, I lay on his tightly made bed, waiting. From the hallway I heard an old man whose nurse was helping him to walk. That Howard Johnson's. It's nothing but the same thing over and over again. That's right. It's nothing special. Late in the afternoon, when slanting sun betrayed a wad of dust under the bedside stand, I heard the sound of casters and footsteps slowing down. The attendants asked me to leave the room while they moved him onto the bed, and the door remained closed for a long time. Evening came. While he dozed fitfully, still stupefied by anesthetics, I tried to read, my feet propped on the rails of the bed. Odette's chrysanthemums were revealed to me, ranks of them in the house where Swan, jealousy constricting his heart, made late-night calls. And while I read, pausing again and again to look at him, the smell of chrysanthemums sent by friends wavered from the sill, mixing with the smells of drastic occasions and disinfected sheets.
That's an excerpt of Jane Kenyon's poem Chrysanthemums, and the poem is included in her new collection of poetry, Constance. When you write a poem that's about Don, or Don, when you write a poem that has to do with Jane, do you show it to each other right away?
Not right away, but we always work together on poems.
Even the poems about each other?
Oh, yes. Yes. We also work with other friends. Each of us has our own committee, you might say, and we work very closely with other friends. But we do indeed work on each other's poems. And there are times when we just, I simply have to say to Don, well, I can't tell you about this because I just can't get far enough away from it to have much judgment about it.
Jane, at what point in the development of chrysanthemums did you show the poem to Don?
Well, it was many months after I started it, and I felt uncomfortable about this poem because I was revealing very personal things in it, and I wasn't sure how Don would feel about it. And I remember prefacing my showing this poem to him by saying, "You may feel that this is too personal, and that I didn't have a right to reveal these things. It's best to be careful about hurting people in this way."
Because I wasn't hurt at all, but I mean, I suppose I'm glad to be asked.
And then, Don, did you work on that poem at all?
I can't remember. I mean, almost always I have something to say. It's famous in our house that Jane will show me a poem and I'll say, "This is going to be good." And Jane will say, "Going to be, eh?" You know, I mean, I love her poems. But I'm always telling her to take out the word "and" there and take the comma out here. Take this line from the end of one line and put it at the beginning of the next. And she tells me the same things, of course. Endlessly. And we often do what the other says, but not always. I don't remember what in particular I said about this, but the fact that it was about me and my illness would not keep me from having ideas about the sound of it, the style of it, the poetry of it. I mean, at first, I read it, it's a poem about me, kabump, I'm struck by it, and then by that fact, and then I start hearing the cadences and looking at the images, and if I see anything that doesn't sound quite right to me, I'll tell her. That's what we're useful for to each other in this particular way.
Is there ever any friction between the two of you of who has ownership over a certain experience that you both shared, and who has more of the right to write about it?
Well, sometimes when something particularly piquant happens to us, one of us will say, "Jump ball."
Or dibs. I remember being with a bunch of poets years and years ago back at Ann Arbor. Jane was one of them, and somebody said something terrific, you know, a good phrase, just adjective, a noun or something, and everybody started yelling, "Dibs, dibs!" on that. I don't think that we've really had any friction on this. We have written about the same thing, but we write differently enough. We can do that. It's all right.
Poets Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon, recorded in 1993. Jane Kenyon died this weekend at the age of 47. We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. We continue with an interview recorded in 1993 with poets Jane Kenyon and Donald Hall.
You've both written about battles with depression. And I'm wondering if you think it makes you more sensitive to each other's mood swings, or if it causes certain problems if you're not on the same mood swing schedule, so to speak.
We try to arrange so that we're not both down or both up at the same time. I think that we try to arrange for one of us to be manic and the other depressed at the same time, so that it's like Plato's ball, or is it Plato or Socrates, who first imagined the human being as a sphere. You know, if you put us together, if you put the manic right. and the depressive together, press them together into a ball, you'd have a whole human being. And I've often thought that if someone took the two of us and shook us up in a brown paper bag and turned us out, there would really be one complete human being.
We have had moments when we were both pretty low, which are very hard moments, because when you're so low, you can't help the other person. But that hasn't happened very often, as Jane says. I think that there is a mechanism in us that tries to, or that is able to compensate when the other is inevitably lower. When I think I had my most recent illness, Jane had been rather low, and she just rose to the challenge totally and was totally nurturing. And then when I was better, she sagged down again, and I was able to help a little. I noticed that. Maybe I'm inaccurate, but it seems
something
like that happened.
No, I did make a special effort to pull myself together there.
It's the time when you think you cannot possibly make an effort, that you're making every effort you can, and circumstances require something from you, and you have it that you didn't think you had.
Jane, I'm thinking here of a poem that you wrote called Having It Out with Melancholy,
mm-hmm.
in which you're basically addressing melancholy.
Yes.
And you say to it, "You taught me to exist without gratitude. You ruined my manners toward God. Quote, we're here simply to wait for death. The pleasures of earth are overrated." How often do you find yourself thinking that now?
Well, it happens. It happens despite everybody's best efforts and all the fancy pharmaceutical footwork that could be imagined. I began this poem not when I was at the absolute nadir, but close to it. I thought to myself, sometime I must write a poem in which I reveal the experience of depression so that people who have never experienced such awful agony, inward agony, so that those people might understand a little more what it's like and stop telling us to shape up, go buy a hat, go take a nice walk. I really meant to speak for all of us who have been incapacitated by our emotional life. And even though I was too low when I conceived of the poem, I was too low to actually begin working on it. I did conceive of the poem when I was in fact a very, very depressed state.
Don, in writing about T.S. Eliot, you were quoting Eliot as saying, "No honest poet can ever feel quite sure of the permanent value of what he has written. He may have wasted his time and messed up his life for nothing."
Yep.
Do you both feel confident of the value of your work?
No. Not at all. It is a matter of mood. I mean, in the morning, when I've been working, if I wander out and see Jane some mornings, I may say, mocking myself, "I am great," or "I am immeasurably great." And another morning, I will characterize myself in terms of an obscenity, meaning I'm no good at all. I never was. And I feel it strongly then, and part of my mind also knows, tomorrow you'll feel different. You don't know. I don't know. There are times when I get depressed about my work and I think nothing is ever any good, more seriously than the mood thing I was talking about, when I really, really feel very depressed about everything I've spent my life on. And there are other times when I feel, not so much confident about it, just happy with it, happy with the endeavor, with the continuing endeavor. That does not translate into anything like knowledge that my work will endure. I had to give up on that a long time ago. When I was, say, 15 years old, I thought I wanted to be, a great poet. I wanted to be on the top of the mountain. And I thought that at some point I would find out whether I got there or not. Well, when I was in my 20s, I began to realize that you never know. And when I asked Eliot the question, "Do you know you're good?" Eliot was the Nobel Prize winner. Everybody thought he was the greatest poet since Dante, practically. I mean, it was a moment of Eliot worship. And when I asked him that, I had the suspicion that he would say he didn't know, and that's exactly what he said, as you quoted him.
Jane, what about you?
Well, the conviction that you may be writing something worth having written comes and goes. But the thing that does not come and go, the thing that remains constant, I think, for both of us, is the desire to really make art and to embody the truth and to make something beautiful and to make something that really makes people's lives better. Gives them deeper understanding of their own existence and great joy because of beauty. That desire never goes.
poets Jane Kenyon and Donald Hall, recorded in 1993. Jane Kenyon died Saturday of leukemia. A book of her new and selected poems will be published in March 1996 by Gray Wolf Press. In a minute, we pay tribute to another artist who died over the weekend, jazz pianist Don Pullen. This is Pullen on his composition, Ode to Life. Pianist Don Pullen. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel joins us to talk about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert. What do you have on the investigation of the bombing in Oklahoma City?
Well, Barbara, we'll be hearing today about events in Oklahoma City, also from NPR's John Burnett about the Oklahoma militia. We'll be hearing what President Clinton had to say about hate speech and how that might contribute to events such as the bombing in Oklahoma City. And our producer, Art Silverman, will have a look at Oklahoma City on a Monday morning trying to return to something approaching normal. Also, news of the French election and of other stories.
Thank you, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz pianist Don Pullen died of lymphoma on Saturday. He was 53 years old and had been battling cancer for several years. Pullen was one of the few modern jazz musicians championed by liberals and conservatives alike. He was a technical innovator who always paid attention to swinging rhythm and improvising on a tune's chords. Over the years, Don Pullen had played with bassist Charles Mingus, co-led a quartet with the late saxophonist George Adams, and fronted several trios and quintets of his own. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation.
Don Pullen playing the blues with Charles Mingus's quintet in 1974. That was the band where Pullen first got widespread exposure, but he'd been active in New York since the 1960s. Back then, he led something of a double life. As a pianist, he played free jazz in Manhattan. At the same time, he led the house band at what he once described to me as a black yuppie place out in Queens. There, he played the organ and backed up R&B and ballad singers like Ruth Brown and Arthur Prysock. For Don Pullen, those two musical worlds were never as separate as they seemed. He was a radical in love with the blues. Early on, his ambition was to give the illusion of bending notes on piano, the way blues guitar players do. He hit on a solution while practicing one day. Frustrated at the piano's limitations, he slashed at the keys with his knuckles and discovered that was what he'd been looking for. For Pullen, it was all in the wrist. In the middle of fingering a melody with his right hand, he'd suddenly whip his wrist around 180 degrees and roll the back of his hand on the keys so fast the notes would blur together. It was striking to see, but he always stressed it was no gimmick. The important thing, he said, was to do it in rhythm and to roll over notes that fit whatever chord he was playing with his left hand. Here's Pullen's trio in 1990 playing his tune, Andre's Ups and Downs. Lightning stroke technique was physically demanding. I once saw Don Pullen bleed all over the keys while playing a solo concert in Baltimore. Folks often assume that he'd been influenced by the older dissonant pianist Cecil Taylor, but Pullen insisted he developed his style on his own. In fact, he said, he deliberately avoided listening to Taylor. In the last few years, Don Pullen led an international quintet, the African-Brazilian Connection, a largely successful attempt to make his music a bit more accessible. They just recorded their fourth album for Blue Note in March. In the 90s, he also returned to playing organ in saxophonist David Murray's group Shaquille's Warrior, where Pullen used some of the same unorthodox moves he used on piano. In effect, that brought his career full circle, reconciling his opposing tendencies once and for all. Don Pullen wrote some nice tunes, which often displayed a Spanish influence that somehow crept into his playing. He originally came from Roanoke, Virginia, not a big Latin music town, as he told it. But Pullen will be best remembered as a player whose own influence has become more and more apparent. Whenever you see a pianist or organist rolling his or her right hand up the keys, Don Pullen is in the house.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He remembered jazz pianist Don Pullen, who died Saturday. Interviews and reviews on Fresh Air are produced by Roberta Shurrock, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike. Alan Tu directed today's program. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Robert McNamara was one of the architects of the war in Vietnam. In his new memoir, he says the U.S. government was very wrong in how it handled Vietnam. We'll talk with former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara on the next Fresh Air.